Hello, I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence here at Sibline, and today we have a very special podcast for you all. Today I'm joined by General Sir James Everard. Sir James is former NATO Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe, former Commander Field Army, former Deputy Chief of Defence Staff and Assistant Chief of the General Staff. Sir James is also patron of the Army LGBTQ Plus Forum. Delighted to have you on, James, and welcome to Sibline Studios. And I'm joined, as ever, by our lead Europe Eurasia analyst, Alexander Lord. Alexander Lord has been at Sibline for 3.5 years and is an alumni of both Cambridge University and King's College London. So without further ado, let's get started. James, wonderful for you to join us here.
Thank
on a fine Monday afternoon in late May. It's great for you to be here again, once again, at Sibline. The title of today's podcast is Command and Control, Adapt or Die. Quite a provocative title. And I'm just at the outset, what are your views as to the main issues, our current doctrinal approach to command and control in the West, in NATO?
I should add, by the way, to your very kind introduction that you know, I left NATO, 3 years ago now, but I am the lead senior mentor for Allied Command Operations. And I think I spend something around about 200 days out in the field doing something somewhere with people. So I hope I'm a sort of abreast of where current thinking is. And I think our current problem is very easy, that our headquarters are too big. They're too identifiable, they're too locatable, too immovable, and therefore far too vulnerable to multi-domain attack. And I think what is so interesting is that this is definitely a black elephant and not a black swan. I mean, we know it and we've known it for years, and yet we're still experimenting with solutions. So, you know, I commanded a tank regiment back in 2002. We were experimenting with smaller headquarters, better campaign infrastructure. I go back to visit, you know, the same units 22 years later, and they're very pleased because they're experimenting with new campaign infrastructure, new ideas. And I think you see the fault here, which is, you know, unless experimentation becomes true progression, then it's meaningless.
Absolutely. So that's really interesting that we're seeing a very kind of slow approach to progress. But just to step back for our viewers and listeners, what then are the effects of targeting command and control and effectively taking out these big immovable beasts, as you describe them?
I think if you look at the Ukraine war, and I credit here, there's a very good paper doing around called The Graveyard of Command Posts, which came out in March. Aral Beagle and Snyder, they're all, I think, ex-military with great military experience, who have been tracking the Ukrainian approach to counter command activity. And interesting enough, I think it used to be defined in our doctrine. You don't see it there so much, but in the old days we defined it as, you know, everything and anything to disrupt, degrade, deny, deceive, or destroy an enemy's information, command, and associated systems, processes, and networks. And the Ukrainians have been doing this relentlessly from the first day, attacking these headquarters, which in their own right are single points of failure because they sit in a chain of command, and if they're removed or disrupted, it takes time and effort to rebuild the networks before you have a stable command and control system. And I think, you know, you often hear people saying, isn't it amazing how well the Ukrainians are striking in depth to hit logistics? You know, and I think logistics is clearly important. But if you destroy command and control, then you've really hit the brain, hit the head, and it takes time to recover.
And to that end, would it be the case then if the roles were reversed? For example, if we was now NATO was involved in a conventional conflict, would we face the same issues that the Russians are currently facing in the sphere?
I think we will, because I think people look at all conflicts, they learn lessons, and one of the lessons you've learned for this is you need more artillery, more joint fires capable of firing at greater range, and that one of the big targets for this, and it might not, you know, it will be multi-domain attack, so it'll be cyber, it'll be special forces, it'll be everything, But one of the big targets is you go after command and control because it disrupts the brain and it takes time to restabilize. And if you believe in this idea of creating windows of opportunity in which you can act, you know, you kill a headquarters, that creates a window of opportunity which you can exploit. So I think, you know, C2 is, it's always been the most important warfighting function. We know that. But having decided that, you really need to work out how you're going to do it. Otherwise, I think you're going to come second.
So we're you know, exploring this topic in the context, of course, of the current Ukraine-Russia conflict. Yeah. And I'd just like to bring Alexander in here. There's some early examples, not just of the intelligence failures on the part of the Russians, which are well, I think, more publicised, but decisive failures in command and control. Can you give us some examples of this inaction at the very outset of the war, maybe in those first few weeks, few months?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've seen a number of intelligence and command and control failures across the Russian war machine pretty much from day one, even beforehand, pretty self-evident as the invasion started to roll across the borders that there were major problems that the Russians were having to deal with. So the intelligence failures from day one, the FSB invasion plans, for example, were predicated on some pretty major assumptions and the failures within that. And I think to a large extent, there were command and control issues at play there. I think one of the key problems with the Russian command and control system is largely to the extent to which political interference is dictating operations at a pretty low level. And we've seen that at various points throughout the conflict. Putin, for example, it's pretty clear that he has been meddling at various points, pretty low down the command chain. And while that's something that all militaries probably have to deal with to various extents, obviously it's particularly apparent given the political system that Putin has built around him. And I think one of those key issues that we're seeing at the outset of the invasion, of course, was often the extremely rigid hierarchical system that we're seeing. And that has significantly curtailed, limited junior officers' ability to, you know, adapt and make tactical decisions. For example, in artillery, as James mentioned, the importance of fire there. And we've seen various examples of Russian officers on the ground, pretty outspoken ones, clearly identifying some pretty big drawbacks here. Ukraine has broadly adopted the NATO approach to fire requests, meaning pretty junior officers are allowed to request this. It seems that the Russians, particularly in the earlier phases of the invasion, senior officers were having to provide this this approval, and that could cause significant delays. So again, undermining Russia's counter-battery capabilities, for example.
And of course, there's, you know, and we'll come on to this, and there's some clear differences, I think, you know, between between the command control structures here, because in Russia, the lack of a competent NCO cadre had a huge effect, didn't it, on that filtered down command and control. That's something that I think in NATO, you know, we have. So can you go into how that played out in the opening, you know, salvo of the war?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Russian military does lack a sort of professional NCO corps on the scale of NATO. And I think pretty much early in the invasion, there are obviously significant staffing requirements, which has placed significant strain on the junior command levels across the Russian military, particularly the ground forces, of course, but also in the VKS and the Navy to a lesser extent. And I think, obviously, the growing staffing requirements during the opening phase of the invasion did mean that a lot of junior officers were promoted rapidly. And I think that would have meant that a number of, you know, even more junior officers that were subsequently promoted lacked that critical experience, that technical understanding to execute pretty complex orders. And I think that has been a particular problem for the Russian military, not just only in the first phases of the invasion, but we're still seeing those issues play out now as, again, experienced officers are being killed. And as every month that goes by, every failed offensive, that experience pool lessens and lessens. And I think we're seeing a negative feedback loop within the Russian military. And that is causing pretty sizable command and control issues further down the command structure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. So, you know, how do you win? It's speed of decision and the lightning execution of orders. And of course, at the beginning, I was talking about the ability to take good decisions. And Alex is now talking about the execution of orders. And there is a different approach. I mean, you know, Ukraine will say that they have adopted an approach of mission command, delegation down to the lowest level, working to common purpose. Yes, and that works a lot better than sort of mass subordination to a rigid command structure. So I think there have been different approaches. You know, and I think one of the lessons, again, for the Ukrainian campaign will be, you know, that once you have instilled that, you know, will in your people, which I think Zelensky did, you know, very well, you know, the will to fight is still the single most important factor in war. Well, once people believe in the cause, then mission command serves you a lot better than a rigid command structure, where often the evidence is that people are frightened to take a decision unless it's been endorsed by someone who sits above them in the chain of command. And I was chatting to some Ukrainians recently in Bucharest with an unmanned aerial systems forum there. And it was interesting that not that they had admiration for Wagner, but they worried about Wagner because Wagner showed an ability to adapt more quickly than the big Russian, you know, elephant. So I thought that was an interesting observation. I don't think that they've adopted mission command, just they have, because they're small, they can be agile.
Lessons from Wagner.
Yeah.
So, no, that's really interesting. So, I mean, you know, we in NATO, we have that NCO cadre. You know, junior officers are empowered. So there's nothing to worry about, right? This political interference Alexander was just talking about. Surely, you know, that truth to power, we don't have that. So everything's rosy. What vulnerabilities do we actually face?
Well, you come back to my, you know, speed of decision, lightning execution of orders. A mission command only works when those at the lowest level understand what the brain wants you to do. And therefore, if your command and control structures are too big and too vulnerable and they get removed or attacked, then, you know, the model starts to break down. Yeah, you need the tools to do the job. You need lots of things, but you need, you know, as I said, command and control, that most important war fighting function. And there's a conundrum here, isn't there? Because in the world where now so much data can be pushed downwards to tactical headquarters, you know, and I was looking here, you know, what's the aim of all the intelligence architecture we have, you know, to produce relevant, high-quality intelligence focused on leadership priorities at the right time, right audience. And of course, you could fill a skyscraper full of systems if you wanted to that give you this data. But actually, you then get into this terrible vicious circle of not taking any decisions because you're still trying to work through the information you've got.
No, that's a really interesting point, that, because I've, you know, myself worked with NATO systems in another theatre in Afghanistan. And is it fair to say the sheer size and of NATO and the interoperability between the various nation states, even in network, you know, network terms, it poses a challenge to C2?
Yeah, it does, because, you know, the alliance is by its nature multinational. That's one of its great strengths. But it only works if you have connectivity and interoperability, you know, particularly technical, between the headquarters and the soldiers you are commanding. And, you know, NATO tends to always find a solution. But it is a question of finding a solution. It's not automatic, because despite NATO's best efforts, going right back to 1951, I think the first STANAG is about communications interoperability. Nations still procure communication systems from their own providers, not surprisingly, which then occasionally or often are not interoperable.
Yeah, it's a really good point. So, I mean, you know, in NATO, I think, you know, in Afghanistan, you had different areas of operations for different NATO member states, to be, you know, broadly, and that was a non-conventional war. How would this interoperability or lack thereof of systems, you know, even of intelligence sharing, for example, within the NATO, how would that fare in conventional conflict?
Well, I think, you know, for those who served in Afghanistan or Iraq, You know, we owned the timeline in large part when it came to operations. Also, there was no pressure on the size of your headquarters. You all know some of these things grew to huge proportions. You know, headquarters of 1,000, 1,500, you know, wasn't unusual. Because it didn't matter. You could have a technical solution that filled a barn if it gave you the solution you needed. Now, when we're saying that headquarters need to be very agile, they need to be small, you know, you haven't got that option. And so that, you know, there is a technical solution here. I just don't think we've alighted on it yet. And, you know, people talk about reach back, you know, just push forward into theatre those people you really need to be there. And everybody else can be going on their normal lives in Bulford or something and serving the operation forward. Sounds good. Does it work? You know, if you're not in the right mind state, can you support a headquarters forward? I mean, I think you can, but we haven't really thought through those in detail yet. And I think we need to. And I think there's some real opportunities, you know, coming up, particularly in the UK Army, you know, one division coming back on stream as a sort of warfighting headquarters when it's been doing out-of-area stuff for a long time. I mean, I, you know, clearly I don't get a vote, but I really hope that it's reinvented, its rebirth is as a truly third decade, 21st century headquarters. And if it is, then fantastic. We'll be showing leadership in NATO in a way that you know, we have a reputation for doing.
So that's fascinating. So some innovative ways there that the UK may be showing leadership and adapting. However, I'll go back to the title, this particular part, Adapt or Die. Russia's been doing the latter rather than the former. How has Russia tried to adapt? Have they tried to adapt at all to these, you know, their C2 getting targeted, the vulnerabilities in that space? Or have they just kept throwing, you know, men at the problem?
Yeah, so obviously there's been a lot of discussion around Russia's inability to adapt, but it's pretty clear that they are adapting, and they do still pose a significant formidable on enemy to Ukrainian forces, and they have been adapting to Ukraine's increasing range of capabilities. So, for example, HIMARS systems have been utilized pretty effectively to hit command and control headquarters pretty near the front lines, and again, this is part of the Russian culture. That we've been seeing that the Russians have had a tendency to deploy pretty senior officers pretty close to the front line and have been getting killed in pretty large numbers for an operation like this. So I think HIMARS have provided Ukraine with that opportunity to hit and, as James was saying, disrupt the brain, disrupt the commands that are coming down. But the Russians have adapted to that, and they've been moving their headquarters, they've been trying to recognise that vulnerability and mitigating it. So recently we've had some pretty interesting intelligence and assessments from various US officials, for example, Ukrainian officials, that have actually raised some concerns around the effectiveness or the diminishing effectiveness of HIMARS precisely because the Russians are responding to this threat and are dispersing their C2 headquarters. Of course, you know, this is beyond they've largely relocated these headquarters beyond the range of HIMARS now. And so, again, that's an adaptation. But again, just this week, we've had confirmation from the UK that we're giving them Storm Shadow cruise missiles, which again will extend Ukraine's capability and range to be able to hit these command and control headquarters.
And of course, you end up in this vicious circle. So you try and give yourself distance to make yourself safer, but then your commanders feel dislocated from the fight and feel forced to go forward, and then they're targeted and they're killed. And I go back to that paper. You know, I think even last week there was a number of senior Russian commanders have been targeted and killed. But that paper I mentioned, the Graveyard of Headquarters, you know, references, I think it's 10 generals and 1,500 colonels, lieutenant colonels. I mean, that's a big chunk of your brain power that's going. And I think they are trying to adapt. I mean, I'm a tank soldier. I remember, you know, with thermal sights, you train gunners to look at thermal pictures so they'd recognise the engine block of a T-72, for example. This day and age, modern analysts can look at the emission profile, you know, lots of yellows, blues and reds, and tell you that's a Guards Army headquarters. Mm. Bang. And so they haven't fixed it yet because they haven't, you know, made their headquarters smaller. And I was with a British division in America recently who had and absolutely recognised their vulnerabilities, had disaggregated their headquarters into three separate headquarters, but they still needed to work in unison to deliver the output. And what you found was it was good for protection, it was good for survivability. But when timelines collapsed, I think the Americans would call it desynchronization. You faced a real challenge of rapid desynchronization. And so people are trying, but we just haven't fixed it yet. And I think my pitch is, you know, we can fix it. You know, we've got such good technology now, not emerging, it's here now, that you can do it. It just requires, I think, a bit of political commitment and military effort.
And there's a few factors I want to unpick there, but before I do, you spend a lot of time, as you quite rightly said at the beginning, with NATO colleagues. And we've talked about some of the adaptions that we're trying to make in the UK. You talked about even back, you know, 10, 20 years ago. Have you noticed, insofar as you can, you know, say, any direct lessons that your NATO colleagues have gone, oh my goodness me, you know, in the context of the Ukraine-Russia war, oh my goodness me, we need to doctrinally change something now. Anything that comes out from that?
Well, I think you just need to look at where nations are spending money. I mean, if you had the chief of defence here from the B9 nations, they would tell you if there's a capability out there which is available, affordable, and gives them disproportionate impact, they're going to buy it. And so you see a lot of expenditure onto deep fires, a lot of expenditure into systems that deny the air to the enemy, man pads all the way through to, you know, higher range defensive missiles. And I think the one that has surprised people is, of course, this investment in combined arms capability, tanks, APCs, guns, because, you know, and we might not want to hear it because there are people who don't want it to be true, but the Western way of war is still combined arms manoeuvre, you know, with technology adding a layer of excellence on top. It's not going to be won by technology yet. And so those nations that disinvested in all those capabilities, you know, including the UK, have shortfalls they need to make up.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I mean, we were all bracing ourselves for a cyber apocalypse, I think, at the outset of the war, which you know, didn't happen. And yes, yeah, certainly the virtue of combined arms, the combined arms approach is, you know, being reinforced in I guess defence colleges, so, you know,
it has. Europe. But the difficult lesson you also learn about combined arms is if you're going to do it, you are going to take significant attrition, which means you have to have lots of it, and it needs to be well trained, capable of dispersing and concentrating at a point of, you know, time. And this takes time, effort, and it takes space, you know. And so you see all these nations, I think, really working hard on their what we would call conventional capabilities, and then really looking at this raft of technologies, some of them very cutting edge, which they can get into their headquarters that make a difference. And I think space is an interesting... I just mentioned space because I think in this era of multi-domain convergence, a lot of headquarters will think, well, you know, space gives me things, GPS, but I'm not using it for anything. Now there are commercial organisations which will put space into your headquarters on which you can certainly find and very shortly target, you know, which is an amazing step forward in very few years.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a really good point. And probably leads me on to my next piece about intelligence sharing, the ability to, you know, provide foresight, insight, accurate, timely intelligence to the commanders, being key in the failure of which has been obvious, you know, on the Russian part, the early part of the war. And, you know, the unprecedented level of intelligence sharing with the Ukrainians show how decisive, insightful, tactical intelligence can give you that edge. In a behemoth like NATO, where you have, you know, so many different countries, systems, classifications,
Five Eyes,
etc. Yeah, absolutely. As I said, it kind of worked in the non-conventional space, I think. But in this, you know, this hypothetical conventional combined arms battle with with the foe coming across the Iron Curtain as it was back in the day. How do you see that? Because that's a key part of C2, isn't it? Like the ability to share information. And I don't think it's there yet, but you might have a different view.
No, I don't think it's there yet. I mean, there's that, you know, a secret shared is a secret lost. You know, there's that sense that you don't share your secrets. Interesting enough, I still think that exists at the very highest level for all the reasons you'd understand, bearing in your background. But the lower you get, the more people have come to recognise that this information, this intelligence needs to be shared and shared quickly. And I think we're not there yet, because actually those with a intelligence background, I think, are suspicious of it, but the whole world of open source information and, you know, the service that provides, I think, will break this barrier down. With one factor, and this is, and again, I'll give credit to Jim Storr here, he was at Staff College with me. He wrote a book recently, I think, something Rotten Land Command in the 21st Century. And he makes this very good point that actually, you know, we've built these headquarters to accumulate all this information, really because we want to eradicate all risk, but war isn't like that. And if you hone it down onto the information you really need, battle-winning information, it's really not very much. Mm. Allowing the commander to make a quick decision so you gain the initiative. So if you can combine all these observations, it's a smaller headquarters you need. You don't need that much information to make decisions. You've got the most wonderful, you know, open source network providing you, I mean, granular detail in moments, which you can link to your high, you know, systems. We're on a winner. It just needs Solomon to pull it all together.
Yeah, an active will. And, you know, we've seen how our clients have been making impactful decisions on the ground on the back of our Ukraine reporting. And just on that, Alex, I mean, the level of intelligence sharing with Ukraine has been unprecedented, as has the declassification of intelligence prior to the invasion, when the Five Eyes, namely Brits and the US, are trying to persuade everybody this is going to happen. Can you just go over, you know, we talked about the NCO card, speaking truth to power, the failure of C2, but there's been some pretty profound failures of intelligence from the Russian side, both strategic and tactical, at the outset to do the human terrain. You did touch upon it earlier, but just, you know, how has that fed into the command process prior to the war? Just touch on that a little bit more.
Yeah, happy to. So I think one of the key intelligence failures and assumptions that were made pretty high up in the Kremlin was that Ukraine hadn't changed since 2014. And the human terrain, as you mentioned, hadn't really changed, and that they could essentially continue as was in the initial invasion of Ukraine, Crimea and Donbass. The Ukrainian will to resist and to fight was pretty clear from the moment the tanks started to roll across the border. And that was something that the Kremlin had not anticipated, and indeed the FSB, who largely had control over the invasion plans. So pretty huge assumption was made, which, you know, started to unravel the operation. I think the Russian plan could well have worked, but again, there were various other issues, interlocking issues and compounding intelligence failures and problems that, started to see the operation start to unfold. But we did see, you know, from a command and control perspective, some interesting decisions, particularly the withdrawal from Kyiv. So again, the command and control can make those sorts of decisions that can, you know, when an order has been given and it is clear that the mission can no longer be achieved, that new orders are distributed, and that, you know, a fairly competent withdrawal from Kyiv, for example, was conducted with, you know, some losses, but it wasn't, you know, on, you know, a major disaster or anything. It was vaguely competently conducted. So I think, you know, intelligence failures have been replete across this invasion, and the Russians are still, you know, dealing with this. But ultimately, you know, the war is prefaced and driven by political considerations primarily. It's just a lot of the decision making are made by politicians in the Kremlin, and particularly one politician in particular. I don't need to name him. And he is having an increasing influence and control over operational, commands pretty far down the chain.
But you never get a second chance to make a first impression,
absolutely,
do you? And I think, you know, as Alex said, Russia fell into a massive mistake in believing that Ukraine wouldn't fight. Again, you know, history will tell us whether Zelensky's decision to stay was the catalyst that, that really motivated people. I mean, I've got people who were there telling me that, you know, people were replaying his speech time and time again, and that was really giving people courage. But I think Ukraine probably fed Russia's belief that Ukraine wasn't going to fight, because they knew if Russia went all out from the get-go, they were probably going to be in trouble. So, you know, I think history is going to be an absolutely fascinating read here. And I'm a tank soldier again. You know, the endless times people would say, look at all these dead tanks. You know, the era of the tank is over. And you're saying, yes, it's a T-72. It's designed to be fought in packs of 200 to break through and then roam in open countryside. It is not designed to be driving through towns at 4 miles an hour with no infantry support. You know, no wonder it gets killed.
Yeah, absolutely. And Alex, we talked there about the NCO cadre, the junior officers, and the political influence. Of course, you can't ignore the factionalization. We're recording this on, you know, late May the 15th. We've recently seen Yevgeny Prigozhin getting increasingly strident in his attacks on the Russian establishment. And surely that factionalization plays into the breakdown of C2 command and control. What's your make of Prigozhin's latest outburst?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good question. And he hasn't become increasingly loud, despite his, you know, he's not a formal Russian commander. And yet, on the face of it, you would assume he has a vast amount of influence and control over operations. So this is very much a political issue, I think. And I think this speaks to the political interference and the political complex decision-making processes which make up the Kremlin's approach to these things and approach to warfare, really. We have seen deep factionalization and infighting remain a plague on Russian command and control throughout this conflict. And this has a pedigree that goes right back to 2014. We've seen, you know, particularly in the first sort of 6 to 12 months of the war, various factions, various semi-independent, semi-autonomous, to varying extents, not terribly great extents, forces, for example, the Donetsk People's Republic, People's Militia, the Luhansk People's Militia, Wagner, of course, all operating under their own commanders, particularly in the early phases of the war, with their own operational objectives, and not all of them are military. A lot of them are economic. A lot of them are political. You know, economic competition has been a dominant driver of military operations in the Donbass since 2014. And we have seen, again, the Russian high command, particularly spearheaded by Chief of the General Staff, Valery Gerasimov, trying to streamline this, trying to centralise and really sort of reassert Moscow and the Ministry of Defence's control over all the disparate forces that are fighting in Ukraine. It hasn't been a single monolith. It's very much fragmented at various points. And I think Prigozhin's outbursts indicate to the extent to which this can actually have a detrimental impact on operational capability and warfighting on the ground. And we have seen, you know, his threats to withdraw Wagner forces from Bakhmut. That obviously is an extremely provocative threat. If he had gone through with that, opened the Russian lines to various problems and would have forced the conventional military to, you know, potentially pull forces that weren't ready from other forces, spread the line a little bit thinner. So these sorts of threats could well have in the future major problems for Russian operations on the ground. But we have seen Gerasimov, the Chief of the General Staff, trying to get a handle on this. And when he was appointed overall theatre commander of Russian forces in January, this is very much, I think, an attempt by the Ministry of Defence to streamline the command and control problems and to try and put some more order into it. And we've seen some successes here. We've seen, for example, the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Militias that I mentioned sort of folded into and integrated into the regular Russian armies, the 1st and 2nd Army Corps. Again, various problems still remain around that, but there has been attempts to try and get a handle over the pretty extensive command and control problems. A lot of them are political.
So James, I mean, a role for private military contractors in command and control structures, as an asymmetric force, or just a political problem that the Russians are having that we have nothing to do.
Well, I think, I mean, you know, you have seen a trend in Western armies to employ private military companies to do a whole raft of tasks on operations. But of course, they do it within that chain of command and within the rule of law. So these are two very different organisations. But you come back to the Russian mind. I think, you know, that, well, there's endless books really telling us that we really struggle to understand the Russian mind. And I think this whole relationship at the higher level, I think, is something we still don't really understand. I mean, it just strikes me that people are playing with rattlesnakes. And if you do that, you get bitten. And you don't play with rattlesnakes unless you've got its tacit approval, you know, to mix all my metaphors. So I think it'll be very interesting to see where that goes. And of course, you see efforts to try and shut down the Wagner enterprise more globally, which I think will be a good thing to do, because I personally think PMCs definitely have a role in providing security in the world today, but they have to do it bounded by the rules of law.
So we've talked about, you know, NATO as it has been for the last 20 years and NATO now going forward, and how it needs to adapt, be that in terms of C2, you know, its adoption of open source intelligence to usurp some of these difficulties in information sharing, the acceptance that combined arms maneuvers actually attrit casualties after a war on terror which accepted no casualties. Yeah. So kind of seismic shifts back to the future, if you will. Where do you see NATO in the next 5-10 years in terms of its doctrine, its structures, as you know, following this conflict? What are the major changes that you see?
I think when you look back at NATO's recent history, I mean, you have a strategic concept in 2010 that saw Russia as a strategic partner. You know, that doesn't change. There isn't a new strategic concept until 2022. You know, NATO is not recognised or doesn't recognise Russia as a threat formally until 2019. You know, these things take time to change. And, you know, successive super ally commanders have got us to the place now that we have, you know, new plans for the deterrence and defence of the totality of NATO's area of operations. They're not fully resourced yet. That's a challenge for our political leaders. But I think as part of that approach, it's going to include much smaller, much more agile headquarters linked to the best of the evolving technology that you can buy. And I think one example, I mean, NATO talk about having a modern alert system linked to indicators and warnings pretty much from the Kurd Peninsula down to the Black Sea. Anyway, 10 years ago, that would have been pie in the sky. Actually, I think you could probably deliver it today, you know, with a reasonable degree of certainty on keeping an eye on the big moving parts of your opponents so that you cannot be surprised. And then if you can't be surprised, then you can have longer warning times, you don't need so many forces forward, and the model starts to work. And of course, so my final point on NATO is we're lucky, aren't we? 31, hopefully soon to be 32 nations. You don't, as a nation, need to have the full weight of capability to win a fight against Russia, because you're standing alongside 31, 32 other people. So the combination of your power is what does the trick. And I think NATO, if leaders back it, and I think the upcoming leaders summit in Vilnius will be very interesting, because they made, I think, 67 we will commitments in 11 pages in Madrid. How far have we got on those? But I think it's heading in the right direction, and people are reminded, if they need reminding, that NATO is a force for good.
Absolutely. And to put you on the spot, Ukraine, NATO, yes or no?
What, Ukraine joining NATO? Bearing in mind that the alliance agrees on the principle of consensus, and therefore 31 nations need to agree that is the best way forward, I think that is a challenge. I mean, I heard Richard Sharef on the radio this morning making a very strong case for why that has to be the way. But I think they can put them on a path to NATO membership, which doesn't mean that you have to remove the checks and balances that mean when they get there, you don't have a worthy partner.
And I think that's another podcast altogether. But Sir James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Alexander, great of you to come again on the podcast. And thank you for joining us. I hope you've had an enjoyable 30 minutes, as have I. Please do remember to like and subscribe, however you got this podcast. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.